AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet, Chevy runs deep.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 153 for June 8th, 2012. More boost than boast. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Mr. Peter DeLorenzo, the auto extremist. Good to be with you, man.
Yeah, man. Buongiorno, Gianni. How you doing?
I'm doing excellent. Excellent, excellent. I've had just a terrific week. So
what
I'm
have you been driving?
Good.
Anything you can talk about?
I've been in a Hyundai Azera.
How is it?
It's good. I mean, it's not making me do handsprings necessarily, but it's a very good car, and like Hyundai's been doing of late. Much better styled than the model it replaces.
So it
much
slides
quieter.
Between the Sonata and the Genesis?
Right, right. I think their strategy's totally right, but we'll see if they make it work. And by that, I mean, shouldn't they just sell a whole ton more Sonatas? But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to be confident that they can, you know, jam vehicles into segments that they think is correct, and whether the consumer does or not is a whole nother thing.
That's a whole nother thing. And then I was in the Acura ILX, the new small baby Acura as well.
The gussied up Civic.
It's a gussied up Civic. And when I first looked at it, I was like, meh, whatever. And then I started driving it and I thought, man, this is kind of a loud engine. But if you jump on it, if you really start pushing that thing, it can be a blast to drive.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
They need anything they can get.
That's right. And, hey, we got to thank our other guest here, our first guest, Elisa Priddle from the Detroit News. Good having you here, Elisa.
Detroit Free Press.
Oh, Detroit Free Press. There I go, being so glib and wrong again.
That's okay. I've hopped around.
Yes, you have. That's right. So what have you been driving lately?
Actually, I was in the Mazda CX-5.
What'd you think?
I fear that one of the Zooms gone out of the Zoom.
That's what everyone's saying.
Yeah.
I got to say, I actually drove it when they had the launch of the vehicle. I loved that thing. I loved it. But mainly from a handling standpoint, it's a very mm-hmm. well-balanced vehicle. But yeah, everyone's
I agree with that, and I like the
power.
Styling. I think it's got a lot of room for the package, mm-hmm. but I don't know. I mean, when you step on it and you need it, there's that hesitation, and, you know, I'm kind of still wed to the old conventional before they brought in SkyActiv. I don't know. I mean, I have to give it more of a shot, but
mm-hmm. Well, I had my brand image meter, the first Auto Extremist brand image meter this week, and I'm going to do it every year about this time, but I think Mazda's floundering. I really do. I think, you know, the Zoom resonated, and they I think they're out-tricking themselves with SkyActiv because they spend all their time trying to explain what SkyActiv is, and when they're done, you still don't know what it is.
Right.
And I think it's a poor choice of handle, you know. Our guest tonight, Ford stumbled upon EcoBoost for what is, you know, common technology now, direct yeah. injected turbocharge. But I think
But the name worked.
Yeah, the name.
A great name. Well, and really, SkyActiv is very much like EcoBoost because it's a suite of technologies, right? So it is still your direct injection, your turbo boost, but it's your light weighting, it's your transmission. I mean, it's supposed to be the whole package. But I agree with you. It's not resonating. And it also, there's something too good to be true in their explanation, because I keep thinking, how does a company of that size that doesn't have the partners that it used to have, how is it able to achieve this holy grail that the big companies haven't been able to do? It just sounds too good on paper.
Well, I just don't think the consumer has enough patience to really find out what SkyActiv is. I mean, EcoBoost, they kind of got it.
Well, you know, EcoBoost says what it is.
Or if they don't,
it's Eco.
They just know it's fuel efficiency. I mean, they're just making a real simple equation.
Yeah, well, fuel efficient and fun, kind of.
The problem for Mazda is that the SkyActiv name came out of Japan. And so in Japan, Western words can have a given cachet to them. It just sounds different or novel to them. Remember, you know, the 240Z in Japan originally was called the Fair Lady. I mean, you know, it would be a laughable car if they had brought that exact same car here and called it the Fair Lady. And so what I'm getting at is, in Japan, I'm sure they said, ooh, SkyActiv, it probably worked. But you come here and you go, what? Sky? What sky? And active? What do you mean SkyActiv?
Maybe they should have just called it SkyActiv. That's the music people would come out of work, really?
That's right. Yeah. And unfortunately for them is what they've got is terrific. I think their approach to doing vehicles is spot on, but SkyActiv hasn't resonated.
Well, I like Mazda products, but, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do too.
They had a place in the brand spectrum when they had Zim Zim. I mean, people say, oh, okay, I get it. You know, there's something going on there. Now it's just like, whatever.
And then this weekend, during the Detroit Grand Prix, they announced that they're going to be racing a diesel, SkyActiv D, in the Grand Am Series.
Well, there's it's such a political quagmire that we probably shouldn't spend too much time on it. But the short story is Grand Am exists purely because the France family did not want Don Panos to control road racing in the U.S. Flat out. They can say whatever they want, but that's why Grand Am exists. And the France have sunk millions into it to prop it up. They pay their teams. They buy cars. They do all kinds of things. And it grates them that the ALMS has, you know, accommodations in their rule book for hybrids and turbo diesels and all kinds of things. And Grand Am's been behind about that. So this is Grand Am and Mazda, you know, Grand Am putting this up. See, we're future racing people and we're going to have efficient cars. But, you know, it's like the announcement is in a vacuum because, no manufacturer said, oh, well, we're going to run again in that class, too. I mean, so there's so much behind that announcement that we shouldn't spend much time on.
Okay, then we won't. But I think it's an interesting way of marketing the fact that diesel engines are becoming more and more available in the U.S.
Oh, yeah. No,
So that part of it.
It's cool.
And for all us diesel lovers, that's...
But the enthusiasts out there already know about Audi winning Le Mans and
right.
Peugeot winning Le Mans. And,
right.
You know, so it's kind of like, okay, you know, again, what's in it for me? Not much.
I agree. But, okay, jumping topics then, what do you both make of Johan Dennison abruptly leaving Audi and then popping up as the head of All Infinity globally?
Well, I know Johan real well, and I talked to him. And even though I know him well, he wouldn't reveal what he was doing, but he said, I've just got to do something. And he was really, you know, Johan, 20 years of his life with Audi.
Yeah.
And he didn't take the decision lightly. I mean, I could tell it bothered him. He considers that his family. But it's just too enticing of a challenge, I guess.
Was it that, or, you know?
Well, that was my understanding. The people that I talked to, same thing, said that Audi, VW, they've got their plan. It's all in place. It's chugging along. He's done a nice job. So in 2018, when all of those things are achieved, and he's a man who's only about 60 at that time, what does he do? Whereas here, he's jumping into something that, you know, shows no, I mean, He's part of that global move of Infinity from Japan. I mean, first time it's not going to be headquartered in Japan, headquartered in Hong Kong. We'd already been teased by Carlos Ghosn, who said, "Oh, as part of the move, we've got our hire in mind," and we didn't put two and two together at the time and put Denisian's name on it. But
leave Audi because
he's done such a good job and seems so well suited.
He's committed to the brand and he's. Yeah. But that's exactly right. You know, he's 52, and you know, he could easily be out at Audi if they decide.
Well, look, they just had
given
a big shakeup. They just had a big shakeup, and the day they announced the shakeup is the day he announced he was leaving. And no, his people, Johann's people, said, "Oh, they're not related." But that's just too coincidental.
I asked him, but you know, and he didn't comment on it. But I know, you know, when you're talking to an executive move at that level, they've been talking to him for 2 months minimum,
right?
Probably
minimum.
Three.
Right.
So.
And Carlos Ghosn had quite a bit before that said, our guy's already in place. So that was
didn't he say that in, wasn't at Detroit, but it was shortly after Detroit he said something like that?
Maybe it was Geneva.
Yeah. It wasn't at New York. It was at Geneva.
Well, the other thing that's interesting is Jeff Coleman was the head of his public relations who went to Nissan. And I laughed when I saw the announcement.
With Jeff's name at the bottom.
That Johann's going to Infinity with Jeff's name at the bottom. And I went, boy, everything comes full circle in this business,
so
doesn't
it? I wonder
it sure
if Jeff's
does.
Going to Hong Kong.
Well, I wonder, too. And I wonder if Jeff said to Simon Spruill, who runs all of Nissan PR, or maybe even to Ghosn himself, saying, hey, look, if you're looking for somebody to run Infinity, I used to work for a guy who could do this with his eyes closed.
Yeah, I consider Johann one of the most talented executives in the business. So it's a huge coup for Infinity.
And, oh, absolutely.
For Nissan, for Ghosn.
Right.
Who knows? Johann could go much bigger than that job eventually because Carlos isn't going to stay forever. Mm-hmm. So who knows? But
and even if he doesn't, he's going to have such a good time, have this great challenge. And, you know, China's still just such a crazy frontier.
It's a wild, wild.
What a great
east.
Way to.
Yeah, whatever.
The Wild East, right.
Exactly.
And remember, Johann ran Audi in Tokyo for Japan.
For 2 years.
Yes. For a couple of years. So he's got the Asian experience, as it were, right?
He enjoyed living there, so.
And, you know, but it's a tall order, adding dealers. I mean, you know, you go to the Infiniti website, I'm sorry, they got a bunch of silver, they're all silver, and you look at them, it's just like, I don't know, really? So he's got that's a tall order there.
It's a tall order, but look how he rebuilt the Audi brand in the American market.
Well, he can do it, and, you know, they're focusing on that market, so.
Yeah, they said, well, after the stretch dam, they're going to have a lot more of vehicles designed, global vehicles, but designed with China in mind.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got a plan to roll out, and they want to build at least two of them within the next couple of years in China. So, I mean, he's going to have a lot of nice moving parts to oversee.
Another development that I thought was interesting this week was Enterprise Rent-A-Car saying that it's going to start renting cars by the hour, not just by the day or the week. Zipcar started this whole concept, a decade ago or something like that? I can't remember how long ago they got started.
Yeah, but Enterprise is a much higher visibility.
Oh, it is. But and it was, I think, 2 years ago, Hertz Rent-A-Car started renting cars by the hour. And so I'm just curious what you all think about this renting cars by the hour concept. I think it's dangerous for the auto industry long term.
It is. The only, if I had to find a silver lining in it, it's that there are so many young drivers coming up the ranks that have no interest in buying a car. So for the people who were never, who would rather spend their money on their iPhone, if they went out and rented a car and caught the bug, then, you know, that's
then
the
maybe
upside.
They buy it.
Then maybe that they would reconsider and you know, find the passion that we all have for
automobiles. You know, that's a good point. I mean, that could happen. But the other thing that could happen is that it continues to marginalize driving and just say, oh, I don't need it. I'll just go around for an hour and be done. And
that's my fear.
Yeah.
And not only that, but that this becomes more and more popular because when you look at certainly the employment situation today, where young people are having a hard time getting jobs or getting good-paying jobs, I think half the reason why they're not interested in cars these days is they know they can't afford them, whereas they can afford an iPad, a smartphone, or what have you. So, sure, I'm going to get all geeked about what I can get, not something that's unobtainable. But as more and more people realize, you know, I don't need to own a car at all. I just rent it for a couple hours. I got to do an errand. Then
that's a danger.
I think long run, the industry is facing a situation where literally the market could shrink by several million units a year. So that's my big fear for. And look, I'm not against these things catching on. If that's what the market wants, hey, go for it. That's how the system works. But I think there's a danger for the automotive industry long term if this stuff really catches on.
Yeah. As I said, unless those people are just, they can't get a job, they're still living at home, so you can either borrow dad's car or you can go out and rent one.
I guess I still retain a fundamental belief in humans loving mobility. I mean, the first time you learn how to ride a bike, you know, I'll never forget when a buddy of mine back in our neighborhood got a mini bike, changed everything.
I mean,
you know, it's all of a sudden like, wow. We used to pound around our bikes all day, and now a mini bike. And then, you know, that changed everything. So I just think the lure of mobility for humans is really great. Well, look at China.
Sure. It's freedom.
Yeah.
The automobile is going to have a far more deeper impact on Chinese society than I think the Chinese realize.
But, you know, it's no secret. We have enclaves in this country that are vehemently anti-car. And, you know, it's become part of the political football and everything else. So It's going to be a rocky road.
Countries like Japan, where there's just, you know, the young people coming up are saying, well, there's congestion, there's no space, I can't park it, I can't drive it.
Well, it becomes a hassle to own a car. Right.
Exactly. It's more of a bother. Right. Or people in New York, where am I going to park it?
Well, I got to tell you, having been at the New York Auto Show, there are a lot of car fanatics in New York City.
Well, and I did a comment about it. They're the most committed enthusiasts I've ever seen because they have to deal with all kinds of things. And yet you go to New York on any given day and you see some of the most spectacular cars and you just say, wow, you got to really love it to have that 458 Italia driving down Park Avenue, or, you know, it's just...
Right. And going back to Japan, to your comment, Elisa, is that Japan still is the third largest car market in the world. China one, U.S. number two, Japan third.
I think they're worried about that the young people aren't buying.
Oh, they are, and they should be worried. But all I'm getting at is here's a country that has extraordinary public transportation. If you buy a train ticket that says your train will arrive at 10:15, just get on whatever train arrives at 10:15, because I guarantee you that's your train. They run so precisely. And that's just the trains. They have subways and buses and whatnot. So even with all that, people still are motivated to go out and buy a car because, to your point, Peter, it's mobility. It's freedom.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going by the train schedule. You're going when you want to.
And don't they have governors on their, even their most, they're supposed to have governors on their high-performance cars and their...
I don't know. I'm sure the Japanese have figured out how to hack through that.
Well, yeah, I'm sure.
I don't know where it stands.
I don't know
out.
Where you could let loose, though, and right. drive it is the problem there.
They used to have, and it still may be the case, like warning signals. So if you go over 70 miles an hour
You know, I think the big thing I've read about what Japan as a society is concerned about is their population.
Declining
severely. I mean, they're not, you know, repopulating at all, you know, not to the level that will sustain the country.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're talking about 2035 or 2040 where, you know.
Much smaller population. Yeah, no, that's another challenge that the country is facing. But you're right, Elisa. Everybody in the Japanese industry is worried about young people not finding cars cool enough to want to own or buy. But I still come
back. They're cool on their video games. I mean, that's the other dichotomy.
But I come back to this affordability issue. I think that's playing as major a role as anything else. And then people will say, oh, well, there's congestion and this and that and... But nobody in the world ever wants to admit that they can't afford something that they want, you know? And so if they can't afford it, it's like, I'm not interested. They'll tell you what else they're interested in. I think that should be a real worry for the industry because car prices are starting to really get high these days. And we're only just getting going. Wait until about the 2015 time frame when the CAFE regulations really start to get stringent. And more exotic or certainly more expensive materials and technologies are needed.
Right.
And
they're holding the line on prices. I mean, we have a much more disciplined industry right now. So they're not slapping $6,000 on the hood the way they used to. And everyone seems to be equally, you know, there isn't somebody who's starting the ball rolling again. They're all,
Well, I'm not convinced we're going to see those standards intact by then.
I'm with you because my prediction is that
politically,
oil prices and gasoline prices are going to go down. I still say, everybody says I'm crazy, before the decade is out, we're going to see it down at $2.50 a gallon, about a dollar a gallon cheaper than it is right now.
Wow.
That's my prediction.
Wow.
I stand by it.
I'd go that low, but.
Well, I would say in today's dollars. So if inflation goes out of control, no, we'll not get down to that. But as stated in 2012 dollars, I'll bet you we get to $2.50 a gallon before the decade is out. We'll see if
we need those Canadian fans to get there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they'll play a role, that's for sure. But it's more like, this shale oil and shale gas. That's the real game changer. That's what I think is really going to, and already has, started to change the energy markets.
Mm-hmm. I hope you're right.
I hope so, too. But, you know, we've got Dan Kapp here, and we really should get him out because we're talking about all this technology that's going to be going on to cars, and this guy runs Ford's advanced powertrain. So, Ben,
we still got to talk about the magazines.
Oh, well, let's do that. Okay, real quick.
Or do you want to run a commercial and then come back and talk about the magazines?
Why don't we run the commercial, and then we'll come back and talk about them. So, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone.
Oops.
So big changes in the magazine world, Peter. Road and Track magazine that your cousin Matt was running, I guess he was told he's no longer going to be running it, and they're moving it from Newport Beach to Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Well, I mean, some of the viewers or listeners might not know that Hearst bought Car and Driver.
Hearst Publishing.
Road and Track, what was that, about a year ago?
Something like that.
And Car and Driver, of course, has been in Ann Arbor since the 60s on Hogback Road, but they have since moved to a bigger building. Road and Track has been in Newport Beach
forever.
50 years or however long they've been in existence. And it was my understanding that Hearst just said, we're going to consolidate. And we're going to move Road and Track to Michigan. And I understand also that they didn't offer any of the employees financial help to move back here.
So this is a way of getting rid of people.
Yeah, and you said, and we've talked about, is this the beginning of the end of the Buff Books for real? I mean, because what's the next step? If they consolidate offices, is there going to be two magazines? Is there going to be Car and Track or Road and Driver, but that's a very real possibility.
Yeah, I think
or Car and Driver with a Road and Track insert, quarterly insert.
Oh, boy.
That's an idea
that would be ugly.
Occurred to me. I know, I worked at Car and Driver.
Full disclosure, yes.
Yeah, full disclosure, I did work at Car and Driver. I was there when they moved from Hogback Road to their new place.
Where's the new place again? Off of 94?
It's kind of like come off of sort of State Street, Industrial Drive or whatever it's called.
Yeah, yeah,
one of those non-memorable.
I was trying to think of the exit, State Street.
But you can look down from I-94 onto it.
Hmm.
But I know, the people that I've been talking to over there so far, they've not been told that there's any physical consolidation. You know, there's talk that they might move their office, but not necessarily that they would move an office and be put together. So there's still some optimism there that they are separate, but I don't know.
What's the point of moving Road and Track to Michigan and not using that office building, right?
Of course.
But except for there's a lot of talk, though, of them moving out of that office building. There isn't really extra space where they are.
So maybe there's a new office building that they're both going
in. So there's been talk that they want to maybe move to the Troy area because some people live up there.
Wow.
There's a lot of balls in the air here.
But I would imagine if Hearst moves Road and Track back here, then there'll be a new building where they'll both be, and who knows that. So three of the four major magazines are in Michigan now, or will be.
Mm-hmm. And automobiles worried that they'll they're always the people who lose staff whenever the other books, something happens. So, you know, they're already sort of girding against.
The problem is there'll be fewer job openings.
Correct. That's how I'm reading it.
If they move the editorial back to Michigan, there'll be fewer openings, I'm
Look,
sure.
earlier in my career, I worked for a publishing company, and I know how publishing vice presidents think, and they're always trying to cut cost, and editorial is exactly where they go to first. Cut staff, cut budget, consolidate, and to your point, that's where we're going to potentially end up with a rodent car or a rodent driver or, you know, whatever.
Car and truck.
Or some sort of insert in the magazine, because to a publishing executive, that's going to look brilliant. They're going to save all kinds of money doing it that
way. Yeah. They don't recognize the editorial differences. I know when I was still there, and it wasn't Hearst then, it was Hachette still, but at one point they talked about, well, why do both magazines, even though they were on different coasts, different parts of the country, why do you need, if you've got people from both at the same event, why don't you just have the videographer for one of the magazines do the videos for both? And there was, you know, huge editorial pushback, obviously, to not do that. But, I mean, it was a mindset, and that was a Hachette mindset. But
no, I'm telling you, that's a publishing mindset.
No, I know.
I wouldn't just single out Hachette or
No, I'm just saying that was that was their thing at the time. And so, I mean,
Hearst
would be that much different.
Right.
I haven't talked to my cousin, so I don't know, but I know he was in California for a long time, then he moved back here, then they moved back out there for Road and Track. So I imagine, if I know Maddie, pushed back on the idea and said, who knows? But Larry Webster is going to be the new editor-in-chief.
Of Road and Track, right.
Yeah.
Larry's a good guy.
Former Car and Driver technical editor.
Mm-hmm. And had been with Pop Mechanics.
He right. kind of took the Jim Dunn position.
Right.
Yeah.
So
I don't know. Yeah,
I'm reading
Larry,
this
nice
as,
guy, but I don't know. Is he a change agent, or is he going to fight back?
I don't know.
I don't know that.
I think this is very bad for the automotive magazine publishing business. I think this is a horrible trend. I've seen this happen in other areas of the publishing world, and that's why I'm saying this is the beginning of the end.
Yeah.
I'm telling you,
right.
This is not good.
If there's four major magazines, should they really all be based in Michigan? I mean, isn't California a car culture?
Sure is.
Maybe not.
Well, Motor Trend will be the only one.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and I've said this before, but Auto Extremist, when I had the idea in 86, it was going to be a car magazine with no advertising and just, you know, test fast, outrageous cars and do outrageous things. And, who knows, maybe Auto Extremist should become a print pub now. Kind of go against the stream.
Right. And I like the idea of no advertising. You'd have to charge to make up for that.
Sure.
But if the magazine was good enough, people would pay for it.
Yeah, they would.
Especially in the UK.
Oh, yeah. they love that stuff.
They do. Well, hey, now we've got to change gears completely because we've got Dan Kapp from Ford Motor Company, the head of all powertrain research. Do I have that right?
Research, advanced engineering, yeah.
Good to have you here with
us.
Thank you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So you were intimately involved with EcoBoost?
Yeah, actually, we launched, while we are research and advanced, in the first 3.5 application, based on time to market, we took it right to launch from the advanced activity, having started some of the development here in U.S., actually spawned by work that was initiated over by our European colleagues on much smaller engines. And we translated it to the 3.5-liter V6 and...
Which is being used by Ford in a lot of applications.
Absolutely.
It's been very successful for you.
That was, and as we said at the time, that would be the initial application, and that became then a surrogate for V8s in some of the full-size Lincoln sedans and crossovers.
And the truck.
Ultimately, then we took it into the truck, and it's been extremely successful.
What's the percentage now of F-150s with the EcoBoost?
It is running over 40%. For the EcoBoost, and
what, now 56% for V6 last month?
Yeah, for V6, now that we have a base V6, it's pushing around 50%, and that's in a vehicle that 3 years ago didn't have anything but V8s.
So. And from a business standpoint, what I love about that is it's a premium engine. You've got to pay an extra $2,000 to get that EcoBoost.
Is it that much?
I believe it is.
Well, it's bundled up with other features.
Okay, but nonetheless, here's a way of putting out an engine package that obviously the market loves and making a whole bunch more money at the same time. It's brilliant.
But you had to sell the munition and say, we want to give you a smaller engine and make you we're going to charge you more for it. I mean, that was a huge marketing...
it's a gutsy move, but when consumers drive it, they say,
all it takes is turn the key or push the button, put it in drive, and go about 100 yards, and you go, wow. So you're right, Elisa. It was a sell job, but it was the product itself that sold it.
Yeah, the product sold itself, and that started both internally, and then we engaged media and stakeholders early in the discussions, and that certainly helped. But it really does... sell itself, so that price premium comes with a performance that is really impressive, and the fuel efficiency of the V6. So it's that and story that seems to be really resonating with the truck customers.
And, right, and now you're going down. You've in displacements. You've got your latest one coming
so
out of Europe. The little 1 liter.
Yeah, 2 liter, 1.6.
Yeah, indeed. So the 3.5 was our initial application here, but we said at the time that what we could do with EcoBoost is deploy it across a wide array of our engines and our vehicle platforms. And now, some 4 years later, by 2013, we'll have an annualized volume of EcoBoost engines up to 1.5 million, offered in up to 90% of our nameplates here in the United States. So I used to talk about this sort of stair-step displacement strategy where the V6s would replace the V8s, but what would then come are 2 liters replacing V6s. We've now got the 1.6 in the Escape.
Keep going, because you even got a smaller one.
As you get to the bottom of the staircase, we ran out of smaller engines for the smaller B and C cars, which then led to the little 1 liter Fox EcoBoost engine recently launched.
Three cylinder.
1 liter.
Which I can't wait to drive.
Me neither.
Tiny little, it would sit in this chair easily, and it's 125 horsepower. And,
wow, maybe we should open or start an auto extremist motorcycle company and use that motor.
Ooh, there is an idea.
That'd be kind of cool. Yeah. Three cylinder.
And Fiat's got a two-cylinder, so do you think we're going to see a lot of this two- and three-cylinder displace or engines going forward?
Yeah, I think, that certainly you're getting down into the neighborhood where it doesn't necessarily pay a lot more return to get smaller, but, who's to say as we go. It depends a lot, obviously, on where the weight of the vehicles goes. So what we've said is that as we weight reduce vehicles significantly, it allows for yet another iteration of this downsizing. But the brilliance of the strategy, technically, it's bits that are out there, right? I think how we integrated and developed, the capability in-house, certainly we brought something to the equation there. But we can use the technology, deploy it broadly across a wide array of vehicles and do it very quickly. Because when we made our commitment to fuel efficiency and a CO2 glide path, it was very clear that the most impactful thing you could do would be to do something that was affordable and therefore could be rolled out quickly and in high volume. So it's the same basic technology, and it's being applied to engine architectures and assets that we already have in place, the Fox being the exception.
So tell us more about that 1 liter. That's pretty intriguing.
Yeah, that was probably, I would say, the first purpose-built EcoBoost engine, and it was actually initiated the work by my team that's based over in Germany, the research and advanced team there, now developed and launched by our powertrain team in Dunton in the UK. It's a, as I said, 1 liter, three-cylinder.
All aluminum?
Actually, interestingly, we chose in this case to do iron for the block.
Okay. Why?
Well, when it gets that small, the incremental weight associated with changing the material actually made for a better value equation to stay iron and really optimize the size. And because it's that small and we're pumping a lot out of it, you know, structural integrity was important. But there were a lot of technologies that we developed as part of that project that we're now rolling out into some of the other mainstream EcoBoost engines, integrated exhaust manifolds, so we can manage the cost and the temperature of some of what would otherwise be exotic exhaust manifold materials, things such as that. So, but it's still basically the direct injection. It's the same bits. We have, because we match turbos for very good torque response, I think it's probably the smallest turbocharger available on the market for that reason.
So it's 125 horsepower?
125 horsepower with a bit more upside, but that's where it's launching. And of course, in Europe, they offer things at different power levels. So there's 125 and then there's 100 PS version as well.
That's interesting to hear you say that it's the first purpose-built EcoBoost engine. So all the others that we've seen up to this point have been just existing engines that you added all the bits and pieces on?
Yeah, they were existing engine architectures. I used to say on the 3.5, for example, that we touched everything, but we saved all the crucial assets. In other words, you know, we looked at every component relative to the temperatures and the pressures and the operating environment. And we did a fair amount of upgrades, but importantly, we were able to reuse all the manufacturing assets, which is where the big investments lie.
Sure, okay? Absolutely.
So similarly, now on the 2-liter, the 1.6, which is a Sigma engine we produce around the world. So those were largely assets that we had in place that we then developed the EcoBoost technology onto.
One of the things that I loved about this 3-cylinder is you have an offset crank so that in the power stroke, the expansion stroke, the connecting rod is literally vertical, so you're getting more efficiency out of it that way, right?
It's a fairly common practice now in inline engines.
But it's not
engines.
In those other engines,
it's not
right,
because,
that you modified to add
right,
bits and pieces.
Right,
on
it applies to any inline engine, and it basically reduces the side loads on the piston, so you get some frictional enhancement, particularly if the combustion pressures are a bit higher. But it's something that impacts your block line, so it's a high investment item. So generally, you don't implement it unless you've got an opportunity for a new.
But going forward, would you say as you go clean sheet, you'll have an offset crank
absolutely.
On all your engines?
Yeah, that's just almost a given on any new inline.
I think it's interesting you made a decision based to go with cast iron, that going to aluminum just wasn't worth it for any number of reasons.
In that particular case, and that's probably the exception to the rule, but if you saw how tiny the block is, it might literally is about that size.
And it's in the vehicles that you got the smallest premiums on, arguably, so
yeah, and
cost becomes a bigger
so cost was
issue.
Very, very key, because now we're putting EcoBoost technology into B cars and C cars, so that's an important consideration. And the overall weight story is that as we do weight reduction at a vehicle level, and we can do that more cost effectively, the powertrain story is now I can go to this smaller powertrain. So it's lighter, certainly, than the larger engine that it's replacing.
So as you go forward, do you have the full lineup that you need in terms of sizes and, you know, all your displacements and your cylinders, and now you just improve that, or is there more room to grow?
Without divulging anything, that we've got, I would say, the bookends, right? There may be some more intermediate points that we can refine upon.
Lisa, that means you asked a very good question. When they start dancing around and don't answer, you know you asked the right.
Well, there might be.
Well, like a smaller displacement V6, maybe.
Or a direct injected turbocharged V8 in the next Mustang.
Well, EcoBoost V8.
No, he already said he's got the bookends, so we have to fill in the gap in between.
Bookends.
And you'll have to do that.
He said bookends in mainstream production cars. Mustang is a little different.
But that's another, I think, nice thing about the strategy is that, we're reusing a lot of the assets, the learning and the tools that we've developed to develop these engines effectively, and how you can use the same engine in different vehicle applications for very different purposes. So that 2-liter EcoBoost engine in an Explorer or an Edge is an extreme downsized fuel economy option. the same basic 2-liter in a Fusion or an Escape is a premium step-up engine, and in a Focus, it's an ST engine.
Yeah. Right?
And it's the same basic. You know.
So are you interested in what's going on in racing? Or you follow that fairly closely about what Formula One is doing or what the Audi's doing with the turbo?
I must admit, you know, I'm not personally a big Formula One aficionado.
But, I mean, you look at some of their technology. I'm sure your people look at some of
them. Oh, yeah, yeah. And of course, Ford has, you know, a very active...
Well, the WRC engine is... That's the 2-liter, right?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And you've got
an
that
extreme performance version of it.
Extreme.
Yes.
It's like 400 horsepower, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So do you eventually want to then have clean sheets of all of them?
No, I wouldn't say that. There really isn't, you know, there aren't huge improvements available necessarily by redoing the structures at some point that may be the case. Having said that, you know, most of the benefit we're getting now with I'll call it EcoBoost 1 is the benefits of downsizing the engine. I said we launched the first one out of our advanced group. Now the subsequent applications are done in product development. What we've now done in my activity is refocus on how we can wring even more efficiency out of these things. So there are additional technologies that we'll develop to further improve the fuel efficiency, because I heard you mention earlier that doesn't get any easier, right?
No, it's only going to get tougher. The turbo guys tell me that they're on the verge of coming out with a lighter, what is it, the impeller and compressor and a turbo, and that you might be able to get another 10% fuel efficiency just out of the next generation turbos that are around the corner.
First of all, it's amazing the developments that have gone on in that turbocharger space as it relates to gas engines. Of course, there was a lot of evolution on the diesel front, but these are different. They're not variable geometry. They're still fairly simple because they have to be cost-effective, and they have to operate in a much higher temperature environment than a diesel. So having said that, yeah, the technology has moved a great deal. There are certainly more players coming into the turbocharger business. I think they see the handwriting on the wall that the volume is certainly going to grow here. And we have seen a number of improvements, what you referred to. So I wouldn't say necessarily that much for fuel efficiency. What's really
not so much out of the turbo itself necessarily, but the turbo then allows a higher compression ratio. And that's where you start to get...
What's really important for us in the turbos, in the way we're using them today, is in their responsiveness and how quickly they can build boost. So you'll see things like Titania turbine wheels and things. Just so inertia is very key, and their ability to spool up is very important as well.
Well, they're telling me that we'll soon see turbocharged engine, small displacement with compression ratios of 11 or 12 to 1.
That would be a stretch on regular fuel. Okay.
Maybe they're talking Europe, where you get better fuel.
Could be, but the other there's another technical approach, which is referred to as more of a Miller cycle, where you can push the compression ratio up, but you have to do that with a little different, a larger displacement engine, because you trade off some low-speed torque there. Mm-hmm. So not unlike we do with our Atkinson engines in hybrids, for example.
Mm-hmm. What's your thinking on the increasing the transmission gears? I mean, we've got Chrysler now getting ready to put 8 and 9 speeds into their entire lineup. What's Ford's thinking?
I think, you know, we... no sooner gotten everything more or less transitioned over to 6 speeds, which was part of that strategy that we rolled out a few years ago, inclusive of the dual clutch technology. I think this move to 8-plus speeds has certainly come even quicker than I would have imagined. We certainly saw it going on primarily in the luxury or premium space, but now very much mainstream, particularly rear-wheel drive in the trucks, and I think that's going to continue to come, and we're certainly, you know, responding to it as well.
As quickly? I mean, are you going to...
not, we haven't announced any specifics yet. And there are there's certainly some more fuel efficiency to be wrung out of the additional ratio span and number of gears, but it's not a given. I mean, you can add more gears and actually lose fuel economy if you don't do it very well. And generally, when you hear claims associated with those, there are other things they're doing in the box to improve its efficiency. So it just doesn't come automatically with more gears. You can imagine you've got more steps to manage on the cycle. You got to get it in the right gears. But there certainly is potential there. The other thing that certainly you can leverage with a wider ratio span transmission is the ability to launch the smaller engine as we downsize more. So there is some synergy there as well.
Is there a point at which it's ridiculous and we should just have a CVT?
Well, there's a point where you get definitely diminishing returns. And we've looked at that in sort of an unconstrained manner. And, it's double digits, but not, it's 10, 11 in that area. Beyond that, it probably just isn't going to make a lot of sense other than maybe from a marketing perspective. But from an efficiency standpoint, that's, we think, technically sort of the end of the box.
More boast than boost?
Could be. And I'd also point out that, and this is the case with CVTs as well. They offer their fuel efficiency not by being efficient as a transmission, but by enabling the engine to run at its most optimum point. And with larger naturally aspirated engines, that's important because they're not efficient, where they operate most of the time, but are at higher loads. So when you downsize the engine, with the technology, you're putting the engine in that sweet spot and expanding that sweet spot. My point is that they're not necessarily additive benefits. We like to say that once you've eliminated the pumping losses more than two or three times, it's kind of a diminishing return. So the additiveness of some of these technologies is something that we have to always bear in mind.
I've talked to some people that thought that what GM calls e-assist, some sort of small electric motor which then allows a smaller battery just to help launch the car as you go to smaller displacement engines. Some people have told me they think this approach is going to go across the board, maybe towards the end of the decade. Do you see that sort of thing happening?
It's, as you say, another form of enabling downsizing. Our view is that EcoBoost is a more cost-effective way to do that at this point. Eventually, when we wring much of what we can out of the conventional engine, the next area of opportunity is in some form of brake recuperation. Now, as we've analyzed that, the highest value way to do that then takes you almost all the way to our full hybrid solution. So these intermediate hybrids may play a role at some point, but actually, as we work down the cost of our full hybrids, which is something that Ford has the opportunity to leverage, it's more absolute cost. But in terms of what you get, once you foray into that electric area, that we think that's the best value solution.
Well, start-stop is something that you're going to be rolling out.
Absolutely. So that's a very mild form of, and that is something that we think will proliferate pretty much through the market.
Maybe. And the only reason I say that is I've driven a number of cars where I didn't like the stop-start. You come to a stop, and it starts again, and it sends a shudder through the car. Or you're coming up to a stop, you're out of the gas for a while, you're braking, the engine stops, it shuts off, and then all of a sudden, I need the power right now, I got to go, and there's a hesitation. And it may only be measured in milliseconds, but it doesn't feel good.
We've put a tremendous effort into developing the start-stop offering that hopefully you'll get to experience on the Fusion with the 1.6 EcoBoost. Obviously, it's on the road in Europe. It's a little bit easier with a manual transmission, right, where you switch it off in neutral. So there are certainly those challenges in doing it with an automatic, and those challenges are twofold. Our North American customer lifts their foot off the brake and smashes the gas and expects a torque response. And so we
set for ourselves very stringent targets that say no compromise. It has to respond that quickly, and it has to do so as you start the engine without a torque pulse that goes through the driveline when you're stopped in gear and gives you that jolt. And we think we've come up with some very clever solutions to those challenges. Of course, one of those is the synergy you get with direct injection, and that's why we're offering it on our EcoBoost engine, because you can actually do a form of direct or compression start, you know, by just injecting fuel, and we can manage the torque rise as as the engine fires.
Is that what you're going to do, really? Use the injector, you know, which cylinder's at top dead center, put some gas in there, light it off, and start the engine that way?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a starter assist, you know, to get it positioned, but we can certainly increase that time, and we can do multiple injections and manage the flare, because literally that first couple of events is at wide open throttle, right? You're at atmospheric pressure, and that's why you get that big torque bump. So we've managed that with a number of strategies working together. But the startup is certainly a part of that.
Who said that our business wasn't complicated?
Yeah. No kidding. Hey, we've got to take another break here, and then we've got to get to questions from the audience. So, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Chevy.
It was more than a car to him. It really was his baby.
Oh, no. That's my old Chevy. Dear God.
Okay, it's time for rapid fire. And, Ben, let's get it going. Okay, Dan, DC Auto Geek wants to know, can you explain how your group works with Ford's electrification group within the company to find ways in which the technologies may help one another?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, I was just thinking, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the electrification solutions as well. We've talked a lot about EcoBoost, but that was, as I said, our high-volume initial solution. While we expand hybrids, we're now introducing plug-ins and the Focus Electric, what we call our power of choice, offering all of those solutions on the same global platforms so customers can decide what they can afford, what best fits their needs. And it gives us the flexibility and adaptability, because that market is going to be unpredictable as we go forward. So we have that flexibility. So to the question specifically, we do research in the electrical side of things within the organization, as well as there's a big team that does the hybrid applications as well. We work closely with them. My direct team doesn't do the batteries and electric motors. That's done in a different part of our research activity. But I also like to point out that with the exception of just the pure electric vehicles, which we think are going to be still a fairly small subset of what will be a growing electrification mix, the hybrids and plug-in hybrids still have internal combustion engines in them and power split transmissions. So we develop the engines and transmissions to augment what we do with the electrical bits. And we have some unique, you know, engine solutions, the Atkinson engine, for example, that is very complementary with our hybrids.
Right, with your strong hybrids.
Mm-hmm.
Rum and Coke wants to know, what about long term? Where do you see hybrids going? Especially, what about other types of hybrids, diesel, electric, or hydraulic?
Ford believes that hybrids will be, and it's a wide range because it's not that predictable, but in the 10-25% of the U.S. fleet by 2020. And that's a significant growth from where we are today. And, of course, that depends on a lot of factors, most notably the price of fuel, and will customers be incentivized to invest in the technology.
Just before you came on here, I stuck my neck out and I said, I think we're going to see $2.50 gallon gasoline before this decade's out.
And of course, that's a threat to us, because we've got the standards to meet, and we really need the consumers to be incentivized to participate and invest
to buy the vehicles to
in the technology.
I think the standards are going to be reduced. I really do.
Do you think the standards will be reduced?
I can't comment on that. What I would say is that they're not that different from what we had laid out for ourselves internally as a target. If you look at where we need to go from a CO2 emission standpoint globally, we set that target for ourselves back in 06 or 07, and that's been our long-term goalpost ever since. And the standards have evolved to be more or less on that path. So, you know, we think that, you know, that's where we need to be. Now, the big question mark is, can we bring the consumer along with that at the mix levels that are going to be necessary?
It's going to be tough, you know, unless you change the definition of hybrid, because unless you throw in the very mild e-assist types, the market right now is still at 2.5% of total market. If you throw in the e-assist ones, it jumps to 3%. So,
As I mentioned, the concern with or the difference with that approach is that it gives you a different cost point, but it doesn't necessarily yield the same benefit. So in terms of the value you get for electrification, and Ford's in a somewhat unique position with the ability to offer this efficient power split hybrid architecture, we will, for the most part, leverage that architecture for our hybrids and our plug-in hybrids, and not necessarily divert off into many different slew. One thing we've learned is developing a hybrid architecture and doing it very well, and you see that in the results we get in terms of our fuel efficiency, is a big commitment and a learning curve, and it's not something you go dabble into to different alternatives such as hydraulic. Now, having said that, we also recently announced, because the power split is a transaxle-focused application, we, nor Toyota, had a rear-wheel drive hybrid in development. So we had announced the partnership with Toyota to develop a rear-wheel drive hybrid trans.
But not hydraulic.
No, it's electric. And of course, the reason is that the development costs are high to do these things. We both had something technically to bring to the table. And ultimately, as you try to ramp these things up, you know, scale is very, very important. So that looked like a win-win situation for us. So those are our hybrid architectures that we've announced and we'll focus on.
To your point, Peter, I was saying, boy, how complicated this business is. Think about it. Here's two of the largest car companies in the world, so financially stable, and yet they have, Toyota and Ford, have to get together to try to split the cost of doing these things.
Yeah. How is that coming, anyway?
It's going very well.
Is everything on track?
Integrally working together very closely. And as I said, everybody's bringing technical solutions and bits to the table. And I'm very encouraged with
that. Are you traveling back and forth, or are you just doing it all online?
Yes, but no, there's a fair amount of face-to-face, which I think certainly helps when you're trying to establish these things, particularly when you're working through a language difference and so forth. Mm-hmm.
Hey, I see we've got a phone call coming in. Ben, let's bring in the first one there.
Hey, panel. This is Youngblood in Cleveland, Ohio. Mr. Kapp, very good show tonight, but I need more diesel. I need more diesel. Can you talk about what Ford's doing with their diesel program and their fantastic direction they're going so far? Thank you. Bye.
Yeah, in fact, I've got another of other diesel questions
diesel
here, too.
Always so, a question. I never do anything without answering the diesel question. Obviously, diesel is very important to us here in our truck market, and we're really proud of the new Power Stroke diesel that we've done. That's been very successful for us, as well as, of course, diesels make up, you know, almost half of our fleet in Europe, so they're important to us. For the U.S. market, and maybe I'll answer your question with more of a question, we can't match the efficiency of a diesel with EcoBoost, but we can close the gap and deliver a similar sort of driving dynamic. I think, John, you would agree. So now the question becomes, for that next increment of efficiency, there is a significant cost associated with diesel. and the cost is higher here than it is in Europe because the emission standards are more onerous and they're getting even more challenging as we look forward.
Except that Europe, when they go to Euro 6 in 2014, pretty much pulls even steam.
Euro 6 doesn't even get to where we are today. And as we look ahead to LEB 3, their stage 7 really only starts to converge. So it does move the needle and it puts more constraint on NOx, but it is still not where we would need to be in the U.S. So having said that, you know, there's that cost. So then the question comes down to, you know, as a value proposition to the customer, are they going to pay, you know, that, you know, multiple thousand dollars for a diesel option? And to me, and here's the biggest question mark, if they're trying to do some sort of a payback calculation, what is the price of diesel fuel relative to gasoline? And, you know, many believe that it's in here in the U.S. that it'll continue to grow relative to gas. So that's a big. So if they've invested in a technology to get, let's say, 10% better fuel economy, but their cost of operation based on fuel price, I mean, the payback could be very challenging, right? And that's clearly something that's very difficult to predict. So what we've said is that we have the diesels in the same global platforms in Europe. We know how to emissionize them. We have that technology, and we've said we would respond if it looks like there's a market there, and there are certainly some testing that market now. But we haven't made it an integral part of our strategy just because of the uncertainty of the volume potential.
But you could be a quick follower, is what you're saying.
We could be. We could be. I think
there's the potential of the customer, the consumer, deciding, wow, diesel's the hot thing, got to have it. So even if it doesn't make economic sense by your calculations, they may say, I don't care. I want it.
That is the question.
And it gets back to them paying a premium for the EcoBoost in your truck.
Absolutely. Will they? But that's certainly a customer that wants and needs that performance and all that comes with it. But you're absolutely right. I mean, if you look at it very objectively, it may not be a good payback equation. What is the diesel market that's out there, and to what extent can we influence that with other alternatives like EcoBoost?
Yeah. I think we'll have the answer in about 2 years' time as to whether diesels are really going to take off here or not.
Yeah.
Okay, we got another question here. Maverick says, why are engines designed with anything less durable than a timing chain? He says, I will not buy an engine with a belt due to long-term reliability and service cost impact.
I'll say most. I'm not going to say all, and I'll tell you why in a minute. Of our engines are done with chains now, because particularly as we get to higher compression ratios and much tighter clearances, you just can't build in the robustness for a failure, right? And certainly that the chain technology has come a long ways over the years. What we have done in the Fox engine is what's called a belt in oil. Okay, so it is a belt drive that is sealed, so you don't have the typical problems there, and it just takes advantage of the developments that have gone on in the belt technology, and it's absolutely as durable and robust as a chain, and it's a new development, but not something that we would likely carry across to other engines, at least certainly not the current ones.
Okay, Bob Longmaid has a bunch of questions here, but one that I want to know the answer to this too. He says, how's laser ignition progressing? He says, let me read this more thoroughly. How is the laser ignition project progressing in England under the auspices of the Dunton Powertrain Labs? And he finalizes this by saying, do not let Nissan be the first to market.
There are many of these sort of advanced forms of ignition, Corona, laser, you name it, that are still very much in a research domain, okay? And frankly, there isn't a pull or a benefit directly attributable to them yet. Okay, and when I say that, you know, where we've gone with our EcoBoost combustion, and even after we may introduce cooled EGR, we haven't challenged the combustion to the point where ignition is a constraint. Okay, in our research domain, when we're looking at much more dilute combustion, whether it be from EGR or lean combustion, then you do start to stretch the capability of the ignition system. Now, you can use conventional stuff at higher energy levels, which might be the solution. But further out, you know, depending on how extreme we go with very dilute or lean combustion, it can get you into those things. But right now, it's very costly, and it wouldn't necessarily deliver a benefit with the technology as it exists today.
Okay, we've got another phone call here. Ben, let's bring it in.
Yes, this is Roger from Fairfield, Connecticut. I have a question for your guest. Why are we using timing belts and not timing chains?
We just answered that one. Ben, let's bring in the next one.
John, Bill Warner in Jacksonville, Florida, about the Rodent Track move to Ann Arbor. You know, Rodent Track has been historically a wonderful, artistic, and respectful magazine. And I just can't see moving it to Ann Arbor and putting them all under the same roof a long-term survival. It's a shame because the art direction of Current Driver, to me, is terrible. And Rodent Track is a wonderful magazine. Of course, I've been a contributing editor there or contributing photographer there for 40 years, 41 years, and I really hate to see that move to Ann Arbor. To me, it looks like the beginning of the end. Always enjoy your broadcast. Bye.
Yeah, Bill Warner is...
For our listeners and viewers, Bill Warner is prime mover behind the Amelia Island Concours, and he's been around forever. And Bill, by the way, we're waiting for an invitation to do Autoline from Amelia Island, and I'm talking to Porsche because Brumos Porsche in Jacksonville wants us to do a webcast from their place, which is close by.
Right.
So we're going to try to coordinate all that, Bill. So be ready for our phone calls.
But I agree with Bill. Look, I live in Michigan. I think it's cool that, you know, anytime more things come to Michigan, but this is the wrong move.
Yeah.
Rodent Track should be in California. It should be in Newport Beach. I agree totally with what he said. This is not a good move, and that's why we discussed it earlier in the show. And
this is
the beginning of the end. This is not good. And, in fact, we have another question down here that ties into it. Test Drive Junkie says, do you think that the demise of the physical paper magazines will lead them to losing their online presence, or will that stay intact?
I think the online presence will stay intact.
I don't.
You don't?
I don't. I think the people who read magazines, well, they're not going to go and sit down and read online, those kinds of articles.
Well, yeah, I guess so, because the people who read in general seem to be going. I mean, nobody, you know, the incidence of reading newspapers, magazines, something, you know, is kind of like a age thing, mm-hmm. to be honest.
It is, but when you look at the other online publications, if you want to call them that, that are outrageously successful, Autoblog, Jalopnik, and, you know, full disclosure, I write for Autoblog too. I mean, they do brilliantly well, but it ain't Road and Track, it ain't Car and Driver. Well, Elisa, you've been there. What do you think?
Yeah, I was there as part of boosting the online presence and giving them a news element. And but, I mean, part of why I went was because, obviously it's a great name, Car and Driver, and it's based on the magazine. And I really believe that the two sides can work so well together, and I think people do go online because they want to see their spy shots and their quick hits and whatever, but they want to sit back with the magazine and read, you know, a great Phillips piece on some, you know, his latest antics, or, you know, or sit there and just look at the art presentation of a Comparo and all of the spec boxes and everything. I really think that the two of them have such a wonderful symbiosis together. And I worry that if there wasn't the print thing as the anchor you know, even though page reads online are often exponentially higher, that's what kind of brings people in. But I think it's anchored by having a print product.
I think it's an age thing. I really do. If you're over 40, you like reading, picking up something and reading. Or I don't know what the age is, but it just seems like, you know, more and more people are not reading newspapers, physical newspapers, physical magazines. They're doing it all online. I mean, if they do it right, I think the magazines could survive online.
But Winding Road.
Yeah, but that's never gone anywhere, has it?
That's kind of my point, is that it's I don't know, digital only.
Yeah.
I don't know how sustainable.
Yeah, we'll see. It is the beginning end of the car magazines, no doubt.
Yeah. But the appetite for reading in whatever form has never been larger, I think. I mean, people have to have news about everything instantly in huge quantity. So it's not that people aren't reading.
Correct.
We just got to figure out in what form they like it the best.
Exactly. I agree. Okay, Brian says, and I'll throw this to you, Peter, Lotus has finally released Danny Behar. Besides Colin Chapman surely smiling in heaven, does this help to put Lotus back on track to building pure sports cars and not those over-bloated concepts he showed a couple of years ago?
Well, no. I think Lotus's deepest problem is their financial standing. And the long-term and recent investors have grown tired of it, and I see Lotus going away. I really do. I don't think they survive.
Great cars, but if nobody buys them, you're not in business.
Well, there are two Lotuses. There's the Lotus that, again, a certain age of enthusiasts linked to Colin Chapman. Mm-hmm. They were brilliant cars, add lightness, all that, all good. But subsequently, the newer stuff is getting lost in the shuffle. There are so many great cars out there. That Lotus, and I just don't think they can survive and because it requires so much money. And the Malaysian interest is obviously waning. I don't think Lotus survives.
I agree with you. I don't think they will survive. I wouldn't describe those concepts he showed as overbloated. I thought they looked rather good.
No, they were good, but they were wildly, you know, optimistic.
Oh, it was smoke and mirrors. Yeah. They were one-off prototypes that they were never going to be able to put in production. And I still say that one of their, you know, the things that was always going to hurt Lotus is they had Toyota engines. Great engines, bulletproof engines, never going to be a problem with them. But when I got a couple of $100,000 burning a hole in my pocket to buy an exotic car, it ain't going to have a Toyota engine in it.
Unless you want an LFA.
Yeah, well, that's different.
That's
because
different.
That's Toyota's car.
Yeah.
Or Lexus's in that case.
Yeah, I just think, Lotus, when they got away from having, like, Lotus Power, it was just the beginning of the end for them. And I had a Lotus Europa, so don't start saying I'm not a Lotus supporter. I had a Lotus, a Europa twin cam, and I loved it when it was running, which wasn't very often, and then the T kept falling off the back. So it would say Laos. But, you know.
Okay, here's another one for you, Peter. Brian wants to know. He says, I was seated at Turn 7 at the Detroit Grand Prix, saw the track deteriorate. Hinchcliffe's eventual accident, this isn't grammatically right. Anyway, Hinchcliffe had his accident, and he's been clowned by my non-Detroit friends about our roads all week. His question, I guess, is, will Penske and company repay for next year or another solution to assure a full race?
Well, they've already announced, Roger, they are fixing the track, and they actually are going to lengthen the track.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, after you go into turn one, you make the right, and then you make a left and go over the bridge, and then that right-hander comes up real quick.
Right.
They're going to go straight.
Cool.
Yeah. So there's more passing opportunities.
So
yeah,
right.
A little more
I think
excitement.
It's almost a mile added.
Yeah. No kidding.
But, you know, if I don't know where we would be without Roger Penske.
I totally agree, and I don't criticize the guy on this one iota.
I mean, and you know, they fixed it, and I said, we're going to finish the damn race, and yeah, it'll be better. It was unfortunate.
It was.
Mm-hmm. You know, kind of, but, you know.
But you know what took some of the black eye out of it was that while the drivers were being interviewed, while they were waiting, to a man, I think, they were all singing the praises of Detroit, of Belle Isle, how happy they were back, saying, you know, things happen in races, I mean, there was nobody saying, you know, the obvious of, oh, my goodness, can't Detroit pave its roads? I mean, that's what was hanging. That was the elephant in the room. Mm-hmm. And they were just not going anywhere near that, no matter how much the questioners were trying to take them down that path.
Yeah, there's always going to be that negativity. But
yeah.
I thought it was heartening how happy they seemed, genuinely happy to be in Detroit and really wanted to know that they would still be coming back in the future.
I agree. That's how I saw it. Okay, look, we're getting down to the end here. I'll throw the last question to you here, Dan.
Okay.
AMC Eagle Ragtop. Was there an Eagle Ragtop? I guess that maybe it's a great online name. Maybe there was a car by that. Whatever happened to algae and biofuel and all that? Where do you see that going, or did it have its run?
Well, there's obviously still a lot of research going on in that space. We still have a renewable fuel standard on the books that says we'll have 35 billion gallons of ethanol by 2020, and there's certain mix of corn-based to renewable, and obviously the rate of development toward commercialization there is still a bit challenged. But having said that, I mean, there's still a great deal of potential there. And I think, you know, we can take the car technology so far, and then the energy sources have to play a role. And I wouldn't say that electricity is the only one. Certainly renewable fuels. There are potentially some nice synergies with ethanol-based fuels with these boosted engines if you just remove octane from the constraint list, if you will. Some of them are, you know, a little further out, the algae base. I'm not that close to it. But I think these things could play a role at some point in time. I don't think there's any energy source that reduces carbon that is out of play. You know, CNG is much more topical these days because of potential supply. And electricity takes you to a point, depending on, you know, how clean your electric grid is at the same time, right? So I think all these things could play a role. It's a matter of when. But they're all, to your earlier point, particularly these alternative fuels, going to be very challenged to get commercially viable if gasoline stays cheap, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Well, that's a great point, too. If you want to reduce CO2 emissions in car, the fastest way to do it is get some of the carbon out of the fuel or dilute it, as it were, with something like ethanol.
Yeah, and we've done work to show that, with the octane and heat of vaporization characteristics of ethanol fuels, I mean, you can squeeze unbelievable levels of torque out of the. If you want to talk about downsizing more, that's certainly one of the enablers that could be out there. Yeah,
cool stuff. Well, thanks so much for coming on with us.
Thank you. Really good
to hear all this interesting things that Ford are working on these days and everyone else. But it's great to hear it from the advanced side too.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
And Elisa, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thanks, Elisa.
Yeah. And dude, I won't see you next week.
because
I'm going to the 24 hours of Le Mans,
which will be, I can't describe how special it is.
I know, because you've been there before, but I've never. This is a boyhood dream of mine,
and believe me, it will be everything and more.
Yeah, so I leave you in charge, Peter, and
we're not on next week.
Oh, we're not on next week,
which makes your job easier.
Oh, okay, that makes it even easier. Okay, but in 2 weeks, we'll talk about the 24 hours and...
The 21st.
Oh, that's the 21st. Oh, so let's talk up the party. We're having our 15th anniversary of Out of Line, the 21st of June. We're going to have a huge party here. So the party's going to be part of Out of Line After Hours, and Out of Line After Hours is going to be part of the party, and that's going to be an awesome show.
We hope.
Or it delves into who knows.
Right. And on that hopeful note, we will sign off.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine this week. There's all that and much more at AutoLine.tv.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.